This episode is sponsored by Shelby Flooring Limited, domestic and commercial flooring experts. For all your flooring needs in Hertfordshire and the surrounding areas, Shelby Flooring Limited specialise in everything from laminate vinyl tiles to carpet and engineered timber flooring, to name but a few. Go to shelbyflooring.co.uk, that's S-H-E-L-B-Y flooring.co.uk, or call 07706 479 860 now. Welcome to episode 86 of the Real Feedback Podcast, and it's a live one from the sunny shores of Brighton. And at the time of recording this intro, I'm still buzzing at what a cracking night I had with my guest, former frontman of the Seahorses, Mr. Chris Helm. With both of us enjoying an onstage tipple, conversation with Chris was frank, funny and highly entertaining. We obviously covered his time in the band and how working with Stone Roses axe man John Squire ultimately led to the band's demise. But we also talk touring with Oasis, the Rolling Stones and U2, writing Blinded by the Sun and a whole lot more. As I'm unable to play any of the live songs Chris played, this episode may seem a little fractured in a couple of places, but engage the brain and you'll be fine. Check out realfeedback.co.uk for all links to episodes and social links, and subscribe for an extra dose of good karma in your life. This isn't an interview, this is a conversation. This is Real Feedback. Thank you very much.
Are we going to have a natter? Are we pouring two into one, or are you going to sit with two glasses? What's more rock and roll? I don't know.
Sorry, this is nearly done.
25 years.
I know.
Is it weird?
Yes. It's really strange. I kind of was thinking about it last year, being 24 years, and then just thinking, all right, I might have to do something next year, but then I forgot. and here we are.
But, COVID fog, probably.
Yeah, it? COVID. I mean, we'll put it down to that. But yeah, it's been quite an interesting one, really. Especially because I made a conscious decision to not play these songs, some of them anyway, for a long time. So I've had to relearn them.
Was that for the reason that is would probably be most people's first guess that you didn't want to?
Well, we're touring, basically. So first of all, I mean, when I joined that band, I knew like three guitar chords, and John knew at least five. So, and there's a lot of his songs were very complicated to learn. So that was hard work doing that. And then it was great fun, but massive, steep learning curve. And then touring it for 2.5 years, I'd say. With lots of press in between, and you're just doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you just kind of think, well, I want to do something new. So when the band split up, I was just like, I'll just do something new, and got together with some other musicians, did something new, and then kind of forgot I was supposed to be playing this other stuff.
Did you know more than three chords by the time you left the
band? I've learned about four.
You gave away the Woolworth story. That was going to be one of my openers.
Which one, sorry?
The Woolworth story.
Oh, sorry.
Well, no, I'm only joking. No. The story that I heard when I was younger was that John Squire walked past and saw you busking, which is not true.
That's typical record company bullshit.
Yeah, it does sound better, but it's not quite. It's
I mean,
quite
I don't think they thought I was interested enough, to be fair. So they were kind of like, oh, so you're joining this band with this guy from the Stone Roses. It must be like a major head fucking man. And I was like, well spotted. Yeah, of course it is. And they were like, so tell me your story, man. And I'm like, I used to be a busker. And they were like, a busker? What's that? And I was like, oh, well, I used to play on the streets and people throw me money. Oh, so you were like a beggar. And I was like, no. Well, kind of, but I was doing something for it. You know. It was a trade. And she was like, oh, this is so good. It's like, it's like some weird Dickensian thing, I think, that she sort of like, I was like Oliver or something. Little street urchin. And it was weird. And they went with that. And I told them that he was a friend of John's called Dennis, who sadly passed away, actually. But I do owe a lot to him. But Dennis, he walked past one Sunday afternoon when he was drunk with he'd been out for Sunday dinner with his family. And I think he said to me, he goes, oh,
my mate's, he's in a massive band, or he was, but he's left him and he wants to set up a new band and he's looking for a singer and you've got right haircut.
I was like, right, okay. So I gave him a tape. Back in the day, if you were a busker and you had CDs, it meant you were earning too much money and would do it. So gave him a tape. I remember going to the train station to get a photo because I had to have a photograph to see what I would look like.
See what the hair looked like.
Yeah. And I remember John's just saying, no, his neck's too fat. Thankfully, I don't
have you heard him play it? No.
I don't have a problem with that.
His neck's too fat.
No, he's saying my neck's too fat. And I was like, wow. So it's pretty picky. And I did have to do about 4 auditions before I decided that.
Well, I bet it was between you and another.
There was a guy from the Steamboat Band, yeah, and he had like a real kind of Rod Stewart sort of voice. But I think it sounded a bit too American, and I think what John wanted to do was kind of more English sounding. So
what was the audition process? Did you sit with a guitar and play for him, or did you play within a band?
I was just playing on my own, and I'd not really done that as I was in a band before. For 5 years, and then when that band split up, I decided to play on my own. So I was really just finding my feet with my 2.5 chords that I knew. It's probably reducing as the conversation goes on. They put me in lots of situations. I think they were trying to test me to see if I could kind of deal with bigger audiences or more varied audiences. So I ended up playing in Manchester at the Roadhouse. I remember it's one of them venues where you stick to the floor, literally. You know, it's one of those real kind of horrible, stinky little
spit
places.
Spit and sawdust.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what it was on the floor, but you definitely stuck to it.
We'll go with spit and sawdust.
And I ended up playing between two metal bands, and it was crackers. And that was the night when John just went, well, do you want to be in the band? And I was like, yeah, all right then. So I did. And we went round to his house, wrote, listened to a lot of his songs. I didn't think he would be interested in mine, but he was, which was nice.
So when you were found by his guitar tech, did he tell you at that point it was John Squire, or did he just say?
Oh, I knew, because York's a really small place. I mean, it's a very small city and it's got a wall around it. That's not to stop people coming in, it's to stop you from getting out. And, Stuart was, like I was saying to you earlier in the dressing room, Stuart Fletcher, the bass player, he was the best bass player in town when he was 12. I mean, he's phenomenal. And he still is. And he just gets better and better. And John saw him playing. I think he'd been to watch football with Martin, his guitar tech, and then went out for a pint and saw this blues band called the Blue Flies. And Stu was depping that night, so it wasn't even his gig.
Yeah, so the original bassist didn't do the gig and gave it to his mate. His mate, John Seahorses, yeah.
Yeah, so, and you know, I think it was a brilliant choice because Stu's the best bass player I've ever heard and met, you know, and played with. So, yeah.
You still play together now?
So I did know that it was going on. I knew there was a thing. So when this guy, Dennis, said to me, oh, my mate in a band, he's, you know, big band, he's just left it, he's a guitarist. I just went, is it John Squire? And I was like, how the fuck did you know that? So, I live in York and I'm not as pissed as you.
So once you got, because didn't he then rent a cottage? I think Andy Watts was then chosen as the drummer by this point.
We didn't
point.
Get a drummer for ages. No, it was mad. That was a bit of a last minute thing. I remember the record company A&R guy, a guy called Tony Berg. And he came over and we didn't have a drummer. And we did have a drummer for a bit called Mark McNeil, but it didn't work out with him, unfortunately. He was great. And Andy was the only other drummer that we knew that could sing because John liked, I think John assumed that every drummer in the world could sing because Rennie could in the Stone Roses, and it's a rare commodity to find a drummer that can sing. So we got Andy, and Andy, we've known Andy for years really for the York scene and stuff. So it's fun.
And what was the, when you went to this cottage, how was, you know, you walk in, you got your guitars out.
It was like Nail and I.
Was it?
I've come on holiday by mistake.
Oh, right. I mean, were you just thinking, what the fuck's going on? This is, we were Rose's fan.
Not massively. I mean, I worked at a venue called Fibbers in York for years. And when you work behind the bar at a venue, mean, you have famous people coming in and out all the time. You tend to sort of become a bit immune to all of that anyway. So it's quite odd to be starstruck. It's kind of just something that I didn't do. So that might be one of the reasons why he probably wanted me in the band, because they just get on with business.
Yeah.
But the whole being in the Lake District was great, because I've never been. I've never even been to Scotland, actually, or anything like that. I mean, I went there later. It was like, I've just realised I'm doing a gig in Scotland and I've never been here before. But, yeah, it was great. It was great just to do music all the time, rather than having to busk and get a day job and then do music if you could afford rehearsal. So it was, that was the difference.
But within a couple of months, well, soon after Scotland, you were then going to go a lot further.
I didn't recognise how big it was going to be until we did do the first gig in Scotland. It was a place called Records in Greenock. And it was supposed to be a secret gig. And it wasn't. it was literally a venue probably about the same size as this, actually. But the stage was probably a lot less deep. And we did the sound check, and I remember it just being excruciatingly loud. I thought, there's no way it needs to be this loud, but it did, because I didn't expect the whole place to be literally double capacity.
Loud because of the crowd?
Oh, yeah.
Right. I thought you meant someone.
And we had to fight our way through the crowd as well, and it was just insane. And it was, that was when I realised we'd been rehearsing for ages, like 6 or 7 months. And then I realised that, this, you know, you rehearse for something, and this is what it was. I was used to people walking past me, throwing me money.
Yeah.
The busiest gig I ever
watching,
had.
They're still watching. Yeah.
And the busiest gig I ever had was like 50, 60 people.
And was there any sort of talk before you started the gig from John to say, right, because he's obviously expecting a certain level.
Was there any what, sorry?
Like a prep?
No.
As in, like, this is what I'm used to, you know, not as in, you have to do this, but
buckle
because
up, buttercup,
your two backgrounds were so, the contrast was so different.
I think he probably just sat there wetting himself, just going, oh my God, just, you know, it was a proper roller. He was just like, whoa. I remember the gig. I remember realizing as well that there was going to be comparisons between us and the Stone Roses, because you got to appreciate no one had heard us. And everyone was expecting it to be the second coming, pardon the pun, of the Stone Roses, because it had John in it, and it wasn't anything like that. Yeah, so it was like the expectation of everybody was weird, you know, from everybody. There was one guy, and I said to you earlier, I remember I was stood at the front saying bye to everybody, and after the gig had finished, and this one lad came up, and he looked just like Ian Brown. And he came up to me, and he was from Greenock, so Scottish, and he swaggered over to me, and he was like going, you'll never be Ian Brown. And I was like, neither will you. You look just like him. It was insane. And then I started to realize that that's what people kind of wanted or didn't want. And you can't please everybody. So you just had to try and figure out who I was and try and get on with it, you know?
Yeah.
So that was something I wasn't expecting and was completely ill-prepared for, I think, more than anything.
So when you got a few songs of yours on the album, how did that, was he welcome to say, like, let's try some of yours? And did you just play, sort of have 20 songs and then pick the best 11?
Well, 11. Mine kind of crept in because they happened when, so we go through all of John's stuff and then John would go out with, I remember, how it first happened, actually. I think John had gone out with Steve Hodge, the co-manager. And me and Stuart were still playing songs, and I started to play one of mine, which was Blinded by the Sun, and it was really fast. It was a bit like a Stooges song. It was like, boom, 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 boom. How would you feel if...
Really?
Yeah, it was super fast. And John was like, came in and he was going,
whoa.
Hang on, what are you playing? Slow it down. I was like, how slow? And he was like, half time. And then I remember singing Living a Lie, and he said, put La La La, Living a Lie. And he kind of like got into embellishing it. And then I was like, there's a reason why he's doing this. He must want it to be in the set. And then I finished it, and he was like, have you got any more? And I was like, yeah, I've got loads. And that was something I wasn't expecting either. So I was very, very made up about that.
Wait, how were you about having your song change so much?
I didn't give a shit. Just...
I was like, just happy to
bring it on. Yeah. you know, yeah. I didn't even really like it that much. So it was like, fine. You know.
Oh, yeah, because we talked about this briefly earlier in the soundcheck about Blinded by the Sun, mm-hmm. where you told me, because you used to live in Brighton.
That's right. Yeah.
And
I lived on Lower Rock Gardens.
One person was happy about that.
That's right.
Where the song came from and why it was written was not yeah. what I expected.
Well, I moved here with a girl, my girlfriend from York, and she wanted to, I guess the grass was always greener really, and we got to Brighton and she didn't want to be here. And I was wanting to busk around Brighton, and it was at the time where Fatboy Slim and people like that were doing really well in Brighton, and no one had time for a singer-songwriter busker. I think the Levellers had kind of milked that one to death. So it was a weird sort of transition. And I remember we had this guest house in Lower Rock Gardens called the Dolphin House, I think it was. And we used to look out of the window. We were right at the top. You could look out over to see the pier, and the sun would always be glaring in through the sun-blasted windows, as you all know, living in Brighton. There's no point cleaning your windows. But our window was always... You get windows that are painted shut that you can't get out. This was painted open, and it was like October, and it was just the wind blowing in. And I remember thinking, God, this is crazy. But I used to walk in the morning, and we had a coffee table, and I just used to bash my knees on it all the time because the sun would be coming through the sun-blasted windows, and I couldn't see bugger all, so... A song about how irritated I was about my girlfriend and being blinded by the sun, and that was it.
Well, he just went, I didn't have any curtains on my window.
We couldn't afford any curtains now. And that was the thing. I mean, it's a breakup song at the end of the day, but weirdly, I get asked to play people's weddings to sing it while people are walking down the aisle. I'm like, why would you? Have you actually heard this song?
Well, in a contrast to Chris, I'm in covers band, and I did a wedding 2 weeks ago, and their first dance was Good Riddance, Time of Your Life by Green Day. The clue's in the title, whatever, that's fine.
Whatever works for you.
So when did you find out that you were going to Hollywood and you were going to have Bowie's producer to do the album? I mean, was there pressure there? We go, that's Tony Visconti. Oh, my God.
Well, it got to the point where they just pointed you in a direction and you went and did what you were told. And, you know... I'd never been to Hollywood before, and I'd never been in a studio before like that. And I didn't know what a producer was. I mean, John had to explain it to me. He said, do you watch films? And I'm like, yeah. He's going, do you know any famous film directors? And I'm like, Martin Scorsese. And he's going, exactly. He said, would that film be crap if he hadn't done it? And I was like, yeah. He's going, that's where Tony Visconti comes in. He's our Martin Scorsese. And so that was it. And he was like, okay. So he was the same age as my dad as well, and quite a bit of a bond with him, really, in some respects with Tony. He's a really lovely guy. More of a psychologist than a producer in some respects as well. He really managed to sort of squeeze the performances out of people.
So he doesn't try and steer too much away from...
No, he knows what you want to do.
You find it yourself, but yeah, he kind yeah, of yeah. steers you towards that.
I've never seen that since, actually, with people.
Hmm. And how was the recording process? Did you play live as a band, or was it track, musician by musician?
Played live and then re-recorded the shit bits like everybody else does.
Was it tape back in?
It was tape. 97. It was all totally analog.
See, nowadays you have the beauty, you just go just delete that. Mm.
You can delete it, but you're never finishing anything either. Just fuck forever.
No. So Blinded by the Sun, I wanted to actually talk about that song, about the writing of it. Didn't realise it was a kind of an Iggy Pop punky song beforehand.
Yeah, it wasn't very good.
But what's your writing process? Do you hear a melody in your head? Do you just jam on a guitar and then something comes out, or do you get a lyric?
I think before, I never used to keep a diary. So my mum's really nosy. When I lived at home, she used to kind of go through my mail. And... if I got love letters from people, or very rarely, obviously, or she used to just read anything that had my name on it in an envelope, which was quite frustrating. So if I had my diary, then I could definitely know that she knew I had one. She'd be rooting around until she found it. I'm not even going to do an analogy on that one. But so I decided to get my sort of thoughts out in songs when I figured out how to write songs. And I didn't think anyone was really particularly listening or paying attention. And that's how I started writing. And often trying to even do cover versions of songs, but not knowing enough about music and getting it brutally wrong. But then writing my own song instead was another thing as well, which I think Jules Holland said that's how he started doing it as well. So that kind of got me off the hook with that one. But I just sort of fell into it, really. Now it's like I probably play guitar parts and then write songs around that. But before it was lyrics and then learning how to play guitar, it's not your primary thing.
Because Blinded by the Sun has more than four chords in it.
I know. I was saying it for dramatic effect.
Yeah. And now I've just ruined it. Yeah, yeah. We're going to hear some more music in a minute, a lot of music. I'm just checking no one's sitting in my chair there. I'm going to come down there because otherwise I'm going to stand behind a curtain and look at the back of your head, which... It's a good back of a head, but I'd rather be there. So just quickly, so once the album was out and then you on Enemy's cover, I mean, that must have been weird to go on a newsagent and go, and touring with Oasis in 97. And this is all within
I kind of kept my head down. I still, my mum's probably got drawers full of all this stuff. I can't bear looking at any of it even now. I didn't look at it then and I don't look at it now. So,
right.
You know. It's I had the best mullet though back in that day.
Which to cover the neck.
I've heard it's quite fashionable these days.
Yeah. But what was that like? So touring with Oasis within a year and a half of being outside Woolworths, you say you were pointed, and funny enough, a friend of yours, Nigel from Dodgy, who's on the podcast, he kind of described that time of being in Dodgy as the same as you just kind of get pointed in the direction and you just go with it. It's such a whirlwind.
Yeah, you do. I mean, you get it's insane. I mean, I think it was probably the busiest time for bands ever. We were just playing everywhere and anywhere. And the whole Oasis thing, we toured with them for 17 dates around Europe. And I remember I'd just been bought this. I actually got put on a curfew because I started to go out with them and try and keep up with them. And I couldn't do it. And I think John had said to our security guard that he was given, if I'm not in bed by 12 o'clock, then Steve Head, our security guy, can knock me out.
12?
12, midnight, yeah. And but I remember once I bought a new guitar. It was this old thing, this old 1950s Gibson. And I brought it along to write with and stuff. And I had it in the dressing room. And Liam came into the dressing room and he picked it up and he started playing Working Class Hero by John Lennon. And I was like, I didn't know you could play guitar. And he was going, oh, yeah. And he did a really good version of it. And he was pretty much sort of three quarters of the way through the song. And then Noel walked past the doorway and then he just walked back slowly and saw Liam and he just went. He walked in and grabbed my guitar, put it against the wall and went, you're a singer, not a guitarist.
Oh, my God.
And then walked out. And I was like, are you always like that? And he was like, is he always like that? And he was like, yeah, he's a wanker.
So. On that note, Chris Hellman, ladies and gentlemen, let's have some more music. I forget your wine.
Oh, I'll forget my wine now.
The thing about talking about the past is about what I did with the Seahorses is that I was surrounded by a lot of people who were also doing... You know, they were in the charts, on telly, all that kind of thing. And it's impossible to talk about it without name dropping loads, which is... but I feel like a proper wanker sat here and coming out with all this shit. I mean, I used to work at Fib as a venue and you used to get all these old guys. And it was kind of borderline, kind of creme brulee, sort of, I used to be in a band, it's a shit business sort of thing. So I really don't want to be that guy, but unfortunately, when you've done stuff briefly for a bit, like I did, it was only a period of like 2.5 years, and then you meet a lot of people. And the worst thing is taxi drivers, when they see you with a guitar and a big bag and stuff and you've been touring around, and they go like, oh, right, so are you in a band then? I'm like, no. I used to be that. They'd be like, all right, anyone we've heard of? I was like, probably not. No. Have you supported any big names? And you'd be like, Rolling Stones, and they just shut up, and the whole fucking journey is just silence, and you're just thinking, he thinks I'm a dick. I'll try not to be, but sometimes I just can't help being one. I'm bereft of wine, but it won't be long. Oh, darling, thank you. But Kevin, everybody, big round of applause there. Right, so here's the name dropping starts. This is very early on when I was in the Lake District rehearsing with John and Stuart. We didn't have a drummer then at that point. John was in his room playing what sounded like I Am the Walrus by the Beatles. And I'm thinking, are we going to be singing that? I don't know. I really don't know the words to that one. I'll have to learn that one. And then he was playing Champagne Supernova. And I was like, what's going on here? So I asked him and he just said, oh, I'm playing with Oasis tomorrow at Nebworth. Do you want to come? And we were like, yeah, sure. Excellent. And we'd never been to one of these fancy sort of like big gigs before. And because we were with John and everyone, we got VIP passes and never had one of them either. I didn't even know what it meant. And I invited my girlfriend along and we were all sworn to secrecy to not mention that we were in this new band with John. But she ended up going around everybody in the VIP pit with a packet of fags. She didn't even smoke and neither did I, but she was going around and she was going, oh, can I have a light for my boyfriend? It's that fella over there. He's actually going to be in a band with John Squire, you know. And she went around loads of people. Jarvis Cocker, he was the first famous person I met and he was absolutely brilliant. Lovely, cool bloke. Even though he was wearing a skirt, he was fantastic. And he was as normal as you ever see him on Nevermind the Buzzcocks or anything else. And he's never changed. Absolute diamond. Mick Hucknall, however, I was like, you don't even, why are you asking him for a cigarette? So she kind of did my head in a bit and the whole day went on and we fell out. And
I wrote a song about it.
And it ended up being on the album. But our manager hated it. He was like, it sounds like fucking Paul McCartney. I wish it did. It doesn't. It sounds more like the bit when you found the save crystal in Tomb Raider.
So we're on the name-dropping stuff.
Well, why not?
We'll talk about the role. So earlier on when we were talking about the Rolling Stones, he said, oh, we were meant to go on tour with Neil Young, but instead it was the Rolling Stones. So I said, oh.
Yeah, he cut his finger, well, apparently, and cutting a sandwich, and then the whole German
thing.
I was gutted because I love Neil Young. He's amazing. And then they said, oh, well, the manager rang up and said, oh, but there's the consolation prize is touring with the Rolling Stones. And I was like,
All right.
I was such a spoiled bastard. It was unbelievable.
So was it a tour? Was it a gig?
There was like a leg of, I think they had a lot of people supporting them depending where they were. So I think in Brazil, it was Sheryl Crow at the time. And they had other bands supporting them elsewhere, Pearl Jam maybe or something like that. But we got the Scandinavian one. So we did those, you know, Copenhagen and Stockholm. And then we did, there's one gig in Vigo, I think it's pronounced, or Vigo in Spain, which is apparently where, back in the 70s and 60s when they were doing Exile on Main Street, that's where he used to go in his speedboat to go and score. Keith Richards. Right, yeah. So it was kind of, I wondered, because it's an industrial fishing town, but it was amazing. I loved it. It was such a great place. It was a real experience. But what I did realise was supporting the Stones was that they've been doing it since they were 19. You know, didn't pick a guitar up until I was 19, and then I started... You know, I was lucky enough to be in a position that I was when I got spotted. But they have this thing where they have this massive machine. It's a monster that they've created, which employs so many people. And not only were they just they didn't have just one setup, one stage. I mean, this was the one, the Bridges to Babylon tour, where they had that big thing that came out, the big bridge came out into the middle. And they had like another one that was ahead of them doing that somewhere else, setting it all up. So they play one night and then go off to the next one and it go. It's a massive machine. And I just thought, that sounds like a lot of fucking hard work. I met Charlie Watts in the toilet. We're in football stadiums, which are oval. And weirdly, their dressing room was right next to the stage with a video arcade for all their grandkids and great grandkids. And it was packed. It was like being in a youth club. It was insane. And they had a toilet on stage as well, which was their toilet. And ours was right at the bottom here. So the stage is there and ours was there. And Charlie Watts had gone for a wander and he couldn't find where he was. I don't think. I think he was a bit lost and he obviously got caught short and went to the loo. And I was going in and he was coming out and he's zipping himself up in his lovely Savile Row suit. And I was like, all right, Charlie. And he was like, fucking hell, who are you? And he wasn't with his security detail. And I was like, I'm Chris. I'm in the support band. I didn't even know he had a support band. And I was like, yeah, I think you do on most of your gigs.
Well, that kind of answers my next question.
Over the last 50 years.
I was going to ask why he started being a support band for Rolling Stones, but clearly I'm assuming that the two parties...
It was presidential security with lots of guys with black suits on, little curly earpieces.
So Mick's not coming in and making your coffee? No,
it wasn't like that. Not like Stella Street or anything. No.
Is it you two as well?
They were the same, yeah. It was weird. In fact, we peeked out of our... You had these stacks of kind of porter cabins, like I think called Yorkoms or something, and they had this crate in there, which was a gift from U2 for the support band, which was us. And they had this crate, which was a big kind of stack of cans of Guinness. And then on top, there was like cases of Moët and Chandon for Black Velvets with this little... But I couldn't figure out how the fucking... How did they get that in the place? It was a big kind of case. Anyway, we looked out of the window. There was a blind and we just went like that. And as we did... The security team, all of them just looked up. It was like something from the Matrix. And they just ran off and ran up and basically said, if you look out the window again, you're not supporting us. The van. So I was like, what on earth is this? Whilst I'm reading this letter from Bono that's written in crayon.
It says, welcome.
Yeah, welcome.
Make yourself at home.
Well, I don't even know what it said. He was in this, you couldn't really.
Oh, it said, don't look out the window.
I think he'd written it with his feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's quite bizarre, but it was a crazy gig. That was the one where they got stuck in the lemon.
Yes, yes.
Spinal Tap.
Yeah. I mean, were you told, because ages ago I had done the singer from the band called The Subways, and they supported Foo Fighters. And before the gig, they had a guy come around and said, right, have a good gig, but on no account should you use Dave Grohl's walkway. You're not to go on that. You can do whatever else you like, but don't go on that. Of course he did. They got told off for it. So... With such a huge stage set up, were they like, right, that's your bit. Don't go over the bridge. Don't touch the lemon. were there any rules like that for a support act? I'm just going to stand
the
there.
The one thing I will tell you, and this is that for every support band, no matter who you are, is that if you support the Rolling Stones, for instance, you have to pay for a ticket to watch them, which I think at the time in the 90s was like, 90 euros at that point, which is a lot for a ticket now anyway. If we wanted to watch him, we had to pay for a ticket. That was really tight. But then you have ones like, but you two were pretty, they're all right, apart from they had little fascist security guards, that's all I remember.
Yeah, yeah. But you could watch them for free.
Yeah.
When they were performing.
The Edge was really cool. Yeah. He was very personable. Yeah.
So all the success, your guys obviously had a few singles out and stuff like that. But then when it came to writing album number two, were there already cracks appearing
from
your perspective?
Just from touring too much and not having a chance to sit down and think about what sort of stuff you want to write. I kind of wrote quite a lot of stuff and I wasn't particularly happy with what I'd written, to be fair. John had written a lot of stuff, which was surprisingly... It's almost like speed metal, the sort of music you listen to when you're watching motocross kind of thing, you know. I was like, and where's the singing on this little thing?
Right.
I can be honest here, I suppose. I've had enough wine, I might as well be.
I gave it to him.
Yeah, there was a point where, mentioning Tomb Raid earlier, where the film was going to be coming out. And I think someone from the record company mentioned to John that, hey, there's this film, Tomb Raider, man, and Angelina Jolie's going to be in it, and we need a song. And he was like, so he tried to write a song for this film, and I fucking hated it. And it was just not what I wanted to do at all. And I don't think anyone had ever told him that what he'd done, no one had ever disapproved of anything that he did. And I was like, I'm not singing that. And he was like, why not? And then that was where the crack appeared. But it wasn't just a kind of little crack. It was a fucking...
And were you constructive, or did you just say, I don't think it's good?
No, I was just honest with him. I said, I can't do it. It's just embarrassing. And he was like, well, how could it be? I've written it.
Because what I found was I'd listened to the first two Stone Roses albums, or the only two, I think. And the difference in those songs is huge. And I wondered if he felt that he had to, on a new album with the same band, had to try and sort of explore different sonic landscapes, and sometimes it didn't work, you know.
I think John is exceptionally brilliant at playing guitar, at writing music. His sense of, he's got a real sense of harmony and melody, which is so brilliant. I mean, you know, he's a massive fan of the Beach Boys. But I think what John does is that he kind of listens to stuff, and he doesn't just listen to it. You know, he's kind of reverse engineering it almost.
Right.
And that's great. But with that comes a lot of rules. And he wants it to be exactly like he wants it. And, which is fair enough. I get that. But, I wasn't the right person, I think, at that point to do it. I was too tired. I just wanted to chill out and write the slow Nick Drake songs, which no one had ever listened to or buy.
Well, I found on the Wikipedia page for the band, which earlier on you proved might not be quite so. What was that it described your first, one of your first bands, Chutzpah, or how do you pronounce it?
Well, Chutzpah
as folk jazz. Chutzpah. And when I said the words folk jazz to you, this look came over you and said, no,
it wasn't. We were nondescript.
So I don't know whether this quote from John Squire is true. He said, I don't think I'm the kind of artist who can cope in a proper band democracy. I require too much control.
Yeah.
I mean, so was it that he was just trying to lead every facet of the...
I think you get certain people who are exceptionally creative, and John is brilliant in, his lyrics are great. His guitar playing is exceptional. The songs are very well constructed. His artwork, when he does his artwork, is memorable and brilliant. And, you know, there's definitely a thing going on there. It's exceptional. He's an fine artist as well when he does his painting, which again is all very, you've got to appreciate that all of these things are very singular things that he does on his own, the very solitary things that he does. And then when he's in a band, I think he expects people just to kind of, facilitate his vision, which is fair enough. There's nothing worse than being in a band with someone who's don't know what they want, you know, and, I think he realized the thing was with him as well is that he kind of what annoyed me was he wanted me to sing in different personas for certain songs on a second album. So he'd be singing one song and he'd be like, make it more Van Morrison. I don't mind Van Morrison. That's great. You know, okay. But, and then make it a bit more Liam on this one. And I'd be like, why? And then it just got to this point where I was just like, you know,
who
Liam,
am I on the,
just
know?
Give him a fucking ring. Get him to come in and sing it. So
didn't it all end with a smash, a bit Oasis, end of Oasis? There was a smash guitar.
No, I didn't end with that. That was just me being a spoiled brat and having a bit of a moment where it was a lovely guitar. It sounded a lot like Nick Drake's guitar. It was this lovely parlor guitar that I had. And I felt like I wasn't being listened to, so I lost my shit and smashed it up. And I woke up in the morning thinking it was a dream and I came downstairs and it was just basically matchwood everywhere. I was like, oh, God.
Oh, no.
And that's when I realised that things were kind of going into a bit of a spin. And which they do, because you just get out of control, really. Mm. No one's telling you to not do stuff. So you do stuff.
So what was the finale? Was it a handshake goodbye at the end?
Now, the last thing he said to me was, I'm going to buy a strip club in the Shetland Islands. I was like, cool, excellent. I've been to the Shetland Islands three times since then, and there isn't, he doesn't know.
Well, before I hear some more music, I just want to go on to, they went on to play with the Yards, which I actually think, is that even Chris singing? Because it sounded, I mean, some of it was reminding me of...
It's Milli Vanilli.
They came back. Some of it sounded like Bush, some of it sounded like Pavement. This kind of real, you sounded like you were off the leash. That was how I perceived it.
Well, it was, because it was like, you know, you get to... The good thing was, like I've said repeatedly, that I'd only just really started to play guitar when I was 19. By the time I was asked to join the Seahorses, I didn't really know much about playing complicated songs or anything. I knew how to sing, but without sounding like an arsehole, I could kind of sing a lot of things, along to things, and, you know. But when it came to the Yards, well, the Seahorses was kind of like, it was do as you're told, and that was fine because it was like a discipline, and I learned exactly what someone else wanted, which was good. But then it annoyed me in the end, and then I had to unlearn it to figure out what it was I wanted to do. And that was a massive journey for me. But at the same time, I met some very supportive musicians who were also just wanting to do what they wanted to do too. So it was kind of, there wasn't this kind of weird autocratic thing going on. It was more of a collective, and we just got on with it. Hmm. And it was, we shared everything five ways. No one was whinging about songwriting credits or anything. It was just fun and it worked. And, you know, we did split up, but that was to do with other things. But we're all mates now. It's totally amicable, the split with the Yards. And I still play with them now. They've played on the Rookery. I want to work with the drummer again, John Miller, and still work with John Hargreaves, and still play with Stu from Stu was in the Yards as well, and Chris Farrell, the guitarist. Right. We just seem to kind of have this understanding that it's literally really basic. It's just like, don't be shit. That's it. You know,
that was the title for the third album that they never got to make it. So what can we expect from the future? What's coming up? More albums, more tours?
I've got, I'm literally in the studio next week, finishing off this album that I've been working on for 10 years. Yeah, everyone grumbles when I mention that one. I lost the files, blah, 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 and I found them again, and da, 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 da. It's a long story, but, it's weird listening back to that now, because it sounds like another band, you know, and I can be really objective about it. When I start, I'm weird. It's like, if I distance myself from it and I listen to it and I think it's someone else, I can tell if I like it or not.
Yeah.
And it's like, if that was someone else playing it, is it any good? Yeah, I really like this, actually. It's kind of my kind of thing, oddly.
Yeah.
So
when can we hear it? When?
That's probably going to be out next year. I'd say April next year, I reckon. And then, I'm doing
it. Can't wait for next year.
Oh, thank you.
Seriously.
But I'm also doing a thing with Alan Leach from Shed 7. He left Shed 7, and he's been doing his solo album. And again, I think this is a collection of songs he's had for like over 10 years. And I sang on a few of them earlier on, like way back. Hmm. And now he's kind of cajoled me to be in his band. So I'm in his band. So there's me and Sam Forrest who produced the Rookery as well. So it's kind of nice just to get all that gang back together again.
Yeah.
And Alan's an absolute star. He's such a lovely guy. Even though he thinks the world's flat, he's all right.
Oh, no. We all have our issues. Well, I'm going to pour you another glass of wine as you go and set up for...
Thanks, I can't. Clearly can't do it myself.
Yeah. It's the least I can do. Thank you, everybody, for coming down tonight. Chris is going to see us out with another set. I'm going to come... No one's in my chair. No good. I'm going to roll off the stage like a drunk badger again, and there you go.
Thanks, Kevin.
Cheers.
Cheers, man.
Thank you, everyone. Chris Hill, everybody.
You take care of yourselves. Have a really good night. I'll see you down at the in the bar area.